Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscow-Wayne. The 21-year-old man accused of killing seven people with a high-powered rifle outside Chicago this week purchased his weapon legally and, authorities say, with the help of his father. Police had been called to his home several times before to respond to threats that Robert Cremo made against himself and others, and in one instance, they seized a cache of knives. The 4th of July shooting has raised questions about how Cremo could have slipped through the cracks in a state with fairly strict gun laws and whether the new gun safety legislation passed by Congress last month would have made any difference. This hour, a look at what's happening in the effort to secure tougher gun safety laws, what's working, what's missing, and what still needs to be done. But we begin in New Jersey, where new gun legislation will now make it harder to get high-capacity rifles, among other things. Joining us with more on that is New Jersey Acting Attorney General Matt Platkin. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Tracy.
So before we get into the new legislation in detail, I want to begin with the recent Supreme Court ruling striking down New York's requirement that people wanting to carry a concealed handgun in public need to show proper cause. New Jersey, as you well know, had a similar law on the books, and I'm wondering what you expect the practical effect of that Supreme Court decision to be for New Jersey and states with similar laws.
Look, I think the Supreme Court in the Bruin decision, when they struck down over 100-year-old New York statute, very similar to what we had in New Jersey, as you mentioned, with our justifiable need requirement, they took a significant step backwards in protecting our residents from the epidemic of gun violence. And I believe the decision will enable violence. It'll increase the number of people who can carry firearms, which is something that has been more restricted in New Jersey and New York and several other states. And frankly, it's a practice that dates back to the founding of this country. So it's very concerning. And what works in a rural state like Wyoming doesn't necessarily work in the densest state in America like New Jersey. And so what do I think will happen? I think the more people carry firearms, the more interactions, whether it be road rage incidents or encounters on public transportation, or just accidental discharge of firearms, we're going to see violence increase. Okay. And that's going to make law enforcement's jobs harder and make it less safe for them and certainly make it less safe for the public.
The ruling also changes the way that gun regulations will be evaluated going forward. The opinion says that state gun regulations will need to be historically consistent with the Second Amendment. Can you explain what that means in layman's terms?
Sure, and some of this is going to be figured out by the courts as cases work their way through because it is a new standard. But look, there's a long history. Obviously, the Second Amendment dates back to the founding of this country, but so too do sensible gun regulations. In fact, these sensible gun regulations predate the founding of this country and are entirely consistent with the Second Amendment. So what we'll have to do is show for our gun laws when challenged, and we're fully prepared to defend them all, that these are based in historical practices, but they are. And they are for a very simple reason, because gun laws are intended to keep us safe. No one's saying you can't have a firearm. But when you talk about whether it be a justifiable need requirement or some of the gun legislation that we're going to talk about in a second that Governor Murphy signed this week, all they are doing is making sure that we have responsible gun ownership and that we keep people safe.
Well, you mentioned that new legislation, and the governor's office did, in fact, announce just this week legislation that will tighten some restrictions around guns in New Jersey. Let's take a listen to what the governor had to say.
There were those who said that we were being too ambitious, that the gun lobby was too strong, and that our political system would not have the will to take on and win this fight. But again, we believed differently. And guess what? Today, we are making Gun Safety Package 3.0 the law of the land.
That was Governor Phil Murphy announcing this new gun legislation in New Jersey. Does this effort represent, to some degree, a workaround? That is, a way of strengthening gun laws without running afoul of the Supreme Court decision?
I don't know that I'd characterize it as a workaround. I think all of our gun laws have been entirely consistent with the Second Amendment. And certainly the Supreme Court spoke to the justifiable need component of our concealed carry permit, but even the remainder of our concealed carry regulations remain intact. And the day after that decision came down, I issued a directive making clear that you still can't carry a firearm in New Jersey without a permit. And you still have to adhere to the other aspects of that regulatory structure, including the background check. So the Supreme Court has said that there are certain historical practices that they want to see us show, but the gun laws that the governor signed are common sense, and they're entirely consistent with the Second Amendment, whether it be requiring training for people before they purchase a firearm, just like we do for somebody who drives a car. It's common sense, and there's nothing inconsistent with the Second Amendment there. Whether regulating ammunition sales so that we have electronic records for when someone's purchasing ammunition in anticipation of that next mass shooting, something we don't currently do. That's common sense, and there's nothing inconsistent with the Second Amendment about it. And cracking down on ghost guns, which are guns that are broken into parts and designed to evade federal background checks. Well, increasing penalties for those is common sense because they're not legal anyway. And then the public nuisance law that the legislature passed, which is, I think, going to be a very significant piece of legislation and allows my office to take bold action against firearm companies who've caused immeasurable harm in our communities, and they've fueled violence, and they've escaped accountability due to a federal law that gave them broad immunity from civil suit that no other industry is afforded. And so really all we're doing is taking common sense steps that I believe are entirely consistent with the Bruin decision, and frankly are entirely consistent with how we've considered Second Amendment jurisprudence for a very long time. Mm.
And does this new law make New Jersey one of the states with the more strict gun laws in the country at this point?
So New Jersey's for some time been one of the states with the strictest gun safety laws in the country. And make no mistake, that's the reason why we also have one of the lowest levels of gun violence in the country. That's not an accident. States with strong gun safety laws have lower levels of gun violence. But it's not zero. We don't have zero shootings in New Jersey. And so everything we can do to reduce those numbers of violent incidents is steps that we should take. And obviously, we respect the right for people to have firearms. We understand that the Second Amendment is the law of the land. But all we're doing is putting common sense rules in place that will keep people safe.
I don't remember whether you mentioned this when you were talking about sort of the key provisions in the new law, but I did want to ask you about age limits like New York has on buying semi-automatic weapons. I think 21 is the minimum. Does New Jersey have something similar?
So we have broad assault weapons bans in New Jersey, and in fact, we enhanced that with this gun package. One of the bills the governor signed bans 50 caliber weapons in New Jersey, and 50 caliber weapons are weapons that could literally take down a helicopter. So why someone needs them is beyond me. But the age limit was a bill that's been discussed in the legislature. It wasn't included in this package, but it's something the governor has championed. And certainly he's applauded what was done in New York.
Yeah. We were just talking about the alleged shooter in Highland Park on the 4th of July in a state, Illinois, with fairly strict gun laws and somehow slipped through the cracks just the same. How concerned are you about that, that there is going to be someone who presents a threat and yet somehow slips through the cracks in a state that has, you know, fairly solid gun safety laws?
Look, what happened in Highland Park, what happened in Uvalde, what happened in Buffalo are tragedies. And we've seen too many of these. I mean, the Congress just passed the most meaningful gun laws since 1994 when they passed the assault weapons ban. But remember, the assault weapons ban expired in 2004. It's been almost 20 years. And I grew up advocating for the assault weapons ban. And I never understood why an 18-year-old would need a weapon of war. And what we're seeing is that these incidents haven't stopped. And in fact, they're becoming more frequent. We're dealing with 10 mass shootings a week in this country. And so, of course, as the chief law enforcement officer in New Jersey, that's what keeps me up at night. And so it goes back to what I was saying before. We do everything we can to reduce the likelihood of violent incidents. And the common sense gun safety laws that we have make that less likely. Are they perfect? No. But do they reduce the likelihood that we have violence in our communities, whether it be a mass shooting or the steady drumbeat of violence that we see every day, unfortunately, in communities across the state and across this country? And I do have to applaud President Biden for championing and signing some federal legislation that will address the very issue you're talking about by encouraging states to invest in mental health and crisis intervention programs, as well as to include juvenile records in the background check system, which hopefully will help catch more of these folks as they're planning an event.
Yeah. Do you anticipate that there will be collaboration with New York, with other states that have similar laws to New Jersey in strengthening gun safety laws going forward?
Well, we already have strong collaboration, and I have to applaud the governor. In the wake of the Parkland shooting in 2018, he was just less than a month on the job, and we worked tirelessly to form States for Gun Safety, which was the first bipartisan coalition of governors committed to addressing the gun violence epidemic in this country. On the law enforcement side, we work extremely closely with our partners, both regionally and across the country, to combat gun violence. And I have to applaud our state police, which does work across state lines to help hold gun traffickers accountable. Because one thing we know is that this is a national problem. And over 80% of the guns that are used in crimes in New Jersey did not start in New Jersey. So we are holding gun traffickers and gun retailers and gun manufacturers accountable who are recklessly endangering lives in New Jersey by allowing guns to get in the hands of people who will use them in violent acts.
Yeah. Do you expect to see lots more litigation around this issue in the wake of the Supreme Court's decision and potentially even another case that lands before the Supreme Court?
Yes. I mean, we've seen a lot of gun litigation in the past, and we'll continue to see it in the wake of Bruin. But I'll be clear, and I firmly believe all of our gun laws are entirely consistent, not just with the Second Amendment, but with how the Supreme Court in Bruin interpreted the Second Amendment. As much as I disagree with that decision, it's the law of the land, and we will defend our laws under that standard. And I'm fully confident that we can. And in fact, I look forward to defending it.
Yeah. We have been talking with Matthew Platkin, Acting Attorney General for the state of New Jersey. Mr. Platkin, thank you so much for making time to be with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
Well, up next, the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act is now law. It's the first federal gun safety legislation in nearly three decades. We will be talking with a pair of gun violence researchers about what the new law gets right and what it leaves out. There is much more to talk about on Radio Times after a quick break.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowain. For the first time in nearly 30 years, Congress passed a bipartisan gun safety law last month. It includes enhanced background checks for gun purchasers between the ages of 18 and 21. It also requires that juvenile records, including mental health records, be vetted for anything that identifies an applicant as a danger to themselves or others. It's a law that, had it been passed sooner, might have prevented the mass shooting that killed seven people at a 4th of July parade outside Chicago this week. The alleged gunman is 21 years old and had displayed troubling behavior long before the shooting. Every day, more than 100 Americans die of gunshot wounds. That is more than 40,000 gun deaths a year, and about half of those are suicides. Incredibly, mass shootings account for only around 1% of gun deaths in the U.S. Gun violence is, as has been said, a uniquely American problem, and meaningful solutions have been elusive. For more on what's working and what needs to be done, we turn to our guests. Daniel Semenza is assistant professor and director of interpersonal violence research at the New Jersey Gun Violence Research Center at Rutgers University. Daniel, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us is Cassandra Carfassi, who is assistant professor and deputy director of Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So let me invite our audience to join us in the conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, or you can call us at 888-477-9499. Daniel Semenza, let me begin with you by asking you a question that I asked the acting attorney general of New Jersey, who was with us just moments ago, about the Robert Cremo case in Illinois, a state with fairly strict gun laws relative to much of the country. And yet he was able to slip through the cracks. He had displayed troubling behavior in the past. Police had been called to the home. They confiscated knives, that sort of thing. And still he slipped through the cracks. What do you make of that as a gun researcher?
Yeah, I think I have to really agree with a lot of what the Attorney General said. The idea for constructing gun policies to try and prevent gun violence is, you know, to try and create something comprehensive. And others, and myself included, have kind of called this a Swiss cheese approach, where states like New Jersey, Massachusetts, California have been very successful in layering different policies on top of one another that fill in the holes that, you know, one policy might have to address one type of gun violence or one issue and make sure that there's coverage within other policies. And so that's why states that have more policies on the books, more legislation to reduce gun violence, have lower rates of shootings and homicides. But the fact of the matter is, even when you layer these policies on top of one another, there are different ways that people can slip through the cracks. And mass shootings, as you mentioned, are extremely rare, even though they don't feel that way these days. And even though, you know, we are seeing them in the news constantly compared to a lot of the everyday shootings that are happening in a lot of communities, these things are rare and very hard to catch and anticipate with one type of policy over another. But certainly in this case, a mass shooting where there is an assault weapon or a high-powered rifle involved, that lends itself to saying, look, we really need to remove access to these guns in general. There's no reason why somebody should have the ability in their state or in surrounding states from being able to get these. And so layering that in with other type of policies really is an approach that I think can be more effective.
Yeah. And Cassandra Carfassi, to you about the new gun safety law that Congress passed in June. How much does that new law move the needle in terms of meaningful gun safety?
I think there's real opportunity in this policy. I mean, I think it's just so important to recognize that this is the first piece of meaningful legislation we've seen for gun safety in 30 years. And no, we didn't get everything we may have wanted, but something is certainly better than nothing. So some of the things that I think have real potential are funding to improve implementation and expansion of extreme risk protection orders. In the Highland Park shooting, this is a real missed opportunity where an ERPO could have been used.
And when you say ERPO, that's the extreme risk, right?
Extreme risk protection order, exactly, mm-hmm. Sometimes referred to as red flag laws. But these are policies that aren't just about temporarily separating someone from the firearms they already have during a time of risk, but they can be used proactively to keep someone from acquiring firearms. And given what we've heard about this individual's background, this could have been a tool that was used given the threats that were made, already removing knives and swords and other things from the home. So I'm really eager to see how that implementation funding rolls out. I think another important piece of this new policy is extending domestic violence prohibitions to dating partners. For a very long time, if you were violent towards someone with whom you lived or had a child or were currently or formerly married and you were convicted of a domestic violence misdemeanor, you would be prohibited from owning a firearm. If you only dated that person, you weren't prohibited. And so there's a little bit of a disconnect in terms of the relationship. So I was glad to see them extend this to dating partners, but it's only a 5-year prohibition, not a permanent prohibition like we've seen with other forms of domestic partners. I think there's a nice opportunity to have this stronger background check system for folks who are under the age of 21. But I would have been great to see Congress do something to more broadly strengthen our background check system, at least closing the default proceed loophole, for example, where after 3 days, if the background check doesn't come back complete, you can proceed with the sale. So we didn't get everything we wanted. There are some good pieces, but it'll be interesting to see how this rolls out.
Yeah. Daniel, what about you in sort of evaluating this new law? What would you like to have seen that was not included, at least not yet?
Sure. I think Dr. Kafazi hit on a lot of the things that were positive, and certainly I would have liked to see something more robust around strengthening background checks, especially that kind of loophole, that 3-day default proceed. You know, that has been a problem in the past for different mass shootings, and that seemed like something that would be accessible to put in and have that involved. The one thing that I really question, and as hopeful as I am about implementing some of the new laws at the federal level, is how some of this funding that has been talked about around mental health treatment and counseling and crisis intervention is going to be used. Because on the one hand, the idea that just more dollars is going to somehow kind of catch mass shooters before they get involved in something, it's very ambiguous right now. And the fact is that most or a lot of mass shooters don't necessarily have classic symptoms of mental illness that a lot of people might consider. They're more angry, isolated. There's a very different profile there. So the idea that mental health treatment or counseling is going to catch this before it happens, it may be possible if it's done in the right way, but I would argue that there's a better way to allocate these kind of dollars, that there are shootings on an everyday basis that particularly and disproportionately impact disadvantaged communities of color, where if you kind of go in and measure, rates of PTSD, rates of anxiety are extremely high in a lot of neighborhoods and kind of corresponds to a lot of the gun violence that takes place in some of America's cities. If there was a way to make sure that the dollars that are kind of being put aside or being used for mental health treatment, counseling, crisis intervention are equitably, you know, proportioned to the places where gun violence really on an everyday basis is happening, to protect those who have been victimized from being re-victimized, survivors of shootings, because most people will survive a gunshot wound 70% to 80%. That could be a really, really effective way of using the dollars that are kind of being put into this bill. But I'd want to see more specific language and, you know, a real equitable approach to making this work. I think that will have a much bigger effect than trying to predict mass shootings with some of this money.
Yeah. You've raised a couple of questions there. And one of them, Cassandra, I want to ask you about, and that is that in this new federal law, I'm wondering how easy or difficult, depending on how you look at it, will it be to enforce that provision about court and mental health records? Because that is part of this, right, that juvenile mental health records would be subject to review. And because of privacy laws, will that be difficult to enforce?
That's a really great question. There has long been a misapprehension that reporting mental health prohibitors or mental health records into the existing national instant check system would be a violation of HIPAA. And this was a longstanding issue where individuals would be prohibited because of an involuntary commitment or some other adjudication. And those records wouldn't be reported or maybe not reported in a timely manner to the federal system, but they would be in a state system. There have been movements to address this issue. We are seeing more records reported into the federal system, but I think it really comes down to the nuts and bolts of how this will work and whether states will have the capacity to check their own state records, perhaps even their own local records, or if we're really going to be dependent upon this reporting into the federal system. I think if folks are going to have to report these juvenile records into the NICS system, the National Instant Criminal Background Check system, we are likely going to see gaps, both in the quality and completeness of reporting, as well as timeliness. But if there is a partnership where state police and local police can work together to assess these more local and state records, that may work better. But it really is going to come down to how these regulations are written so that we know how this will actually work in practice.
Another point that Daniel just brought up is that mental health is often cited as a cause of gun violence. But I'm wondering how accurate that is. I mean, he just pointed out that, you know, mental health can mean a lot of different things. And so often we hear it in the immediate aftermath, let's say, of a mass shooting. Is the connection as strong as it might sound?
It's actually not as strong as people make it out to seem, particularly in the wake of a mass shooting. We have colleagues in our center who dedicate their time to studying mental health and the intersection of mental health and firearms, and they frequently talk about, even if we could get perfect mental health services for everyone who needed it, and even if everyone was perfectly adherent, meaning they did what they needed to do, they took their medication, they went to therapy, treatment, whatever, we might be able to reduce interpersonal violence by 10% or less. It's far more likely that someone with a mental health issue is going to be a victim of a crime or harm themselves with a firearm. And so certainly there are implications for suicide prevention and understanding the likelihood that someone who has a mental illness or is experiencing a mental health crisis may harm themselves. And this is where extreme risk protection orders might come in. But it's also really important to keep in mind that people who are committing mass shootings, while they may have anger, frustration, other kinds of emotions or anger issues that are leading them to do the things that they're doing, it is unlikely that they actually have a diagnosable mental illness. But when we focus on that, when we focus on the mental health issue, it's really a distraction away from the one through line in all forms of gun violence in this country, which is the gun. It distracts us from what we need to be talking about, which is how are people who are using guns to harm themselves or others gaining such easy access to them?
Yeah. And Daniel, that raises a question about just the sheer proliferation of guns in this country. We live in a country with more guns than people. You have talked about the equation that sounds really simple, but is true. More guns equals more gun deaths. Talk about just the sheer volume of guns in this country. You know, there's no meaningful way to retrieve all of those guns. What do we do about that?
Yeah, it's almost, I say it enough times and I have a conversation with enough people that I'm starting to feel like I'm kind of losing it a little bit, because more guns equals more deaths should not be an interesting thing to talk about. It shouldn't be something that is novel or unique. You know, it's a relationship that has been really confirmed in academic research over a number of decades at this point. There has been different attempts by kind of bad science to discredit this. The idea of a good guy with a gun reducing gun deaths has really kind of grown into a popular type of thing that has distracted, again, from this very basic fact. But, you know, there's research in the home that says that if there is a gun present, it increases the risk of suicide, homicide, you know, domestic partner incidents, and accidental shootings. That same thing is extrapolated out to the neighborhood level when there are more guns in the neighborhoods. However you measure that, there are more shootings and homicides, all the way up to differences between states and, of course, countries. We have more guns in this country than anywhere else in the world, more than we do people by far. And, you know, to really echo what Dr. Kravazi said, anything that kind of distracts from this very basic equation is an attempt to kind of move away from something that we really need to be focusing on, which is how do you reduce access to guns for people who are going to harm themselves or others? And I think that this kind of layered policy approach has to be taken, but it has to be taken comprehensively, not just state by state. right? Because like I mentioned, you know, New Jersey, California, Massachusetts, New York, these states that have more restrictive gun laws have lower rates of gun violence, but they are often neighbored by states who have far less strict access. Or in the case of somewhere like New Jersey and New York, there are a lot of guns that illegally come up from southern states that are much easier to get guns. They come up the I-95 corridor and then get kind of dispersed from there. There are all these different channels where guns move from gun dealers and kind of legal access, and I'm using quotes, to kind of secondary black markets where guns are then illegally accessible and are then used in shootings. And so it's not about doing this in an isolated way where certain places benefit from gun restrictions and other places don't. It really has to be an all-in comprehensive approach, because state lines are just, you know, imaginary, and we can cross over those lines, and that causes a lot of the problems.
Yeah. Our listeners have quite a bit to say, too. I just want to read a couple of comments that have come in on this particular point. Paul says, there are so many guns, it seems unlikely we can make a dent in that. But what about going after the mindset that seems particularly common among white young men, that they are entitled to commit these horrific acts of violence against society? That is a question there from Paul. And then there's also an email from Eric who says, I think we must not ignore the threat that the 400 million guns in private hands poses for our democracy. I know people who think they must have guns because they see the government as the enemy. Some politicians support this extremist view, and it helps explain why they saw January 6th as a dress rehearsal for a right-wing revolution. So a number of comments there just about the sheer proliferation of guns in American society and the difficulty of being able to, you know, what do we do once the guns are out there, as you just talked about, Daniel, and what, you know, what recourse do we have as a society? So certainly something that is on the minds of our listeners. There is much more to talk about on this issue. We're talking about gun safety, about the new federal legislation, how far it goes, what's missing, what still needs to be done to really secure meaningful gun safety in the United States. We'll talk about that and much more when Radio Times comes right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And you're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about gun safety, specifically in light of the mass shooting in Highland Park outside Chicago on the 4th of July, but also in light of the new federal gun safety legislation, the bipartisan legislation, the first of its kind in nearly 30 years, as well as, of course, the Supreme Court ruling that made it easier for people to carry concealed handguns in public. The questions that we're raising are, where are we in this effort to secure greater gun safety in America? What do the new laws provide, and what is missing, and what still needs to be done? With that in mind, our guests are Daniel Semenza, who is assistant professor and director of interpersonal violence research at the New Jersey Gun Violence Research Center at Rutgers. Also with us is Cassandra Crifazzi, who is assistant professor and deputy director of Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence. Daniel Semenza, you have written about the four different types of gun violence. And I think when we think gun violence, we think either interpersonal violence, we think about homicides, and we've been hearing about those soaring, and we think mass shootings, but it's more than that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not the first person to talk about this. A lot of this comes from a colleague of mine, Thomas Apt, who has really thought about how to characterize these different issues. But a lot of times when gun violence is talked about in the news and kind of popular media, it's typified as gun violence with a capital G, capital V, and it's this one monolithic thing that we, you know, think about, or maybe we think about homicide versus suicide, and that's really it. But really, in the United States, and when we talk about gun violence, we really have to talk about four different problems, because you know, you have to talk about them separately because there are different legislation and ways of preventing and reducing those types that are not necessarily going to apply one to the other. And those are mass shootings, suicide, any types of shootings or homicides related to domestic or intimate partner relations, and then the interpersonal disputes that occur typically in disadvantaged communities that disproportionately impact Black and brown communities in cities, right? Those are the shootings that are happening on a more frequent basis every day, homicides and non-fatal shootings. Each one of these has very different policy implications because an assault rifle ban could potentially meaningfully have an effect in reducing mass shootings, right? Those are rare instances where a lot of people are injured or killed, and a lot of those incidents take place with high-powered rifles. But that's not necessarily going to do anything for reducing rates of suicides mm-hmm. or reducing the rate of interpersonal disputes that are happening in America's cities where most of those shootings are taking place with handguns, right? So that's just one example. Another might be that ERPO laws or red flag laws where the more recent bill has kind of focused could be really effective for intimate partner homicides or domestic violence issues, but may not necessarily have the same application for kind of the everyday community violence shootings that are happening in cities. And so I think that if we think about it in this kind of separated way and how you can create policies for each one that, again, layer on top of one another, and I'll just continue to use that term, then you could think about a more comprehensive way of really addressing gun violence with a capital G, capital V, that will have a meaningful effect overall.
Yeah. Cassandra Kerfassi, you yourself are a gun policy researcher, but you're also a gun owner and you shoot for sport. Tell us about how those two worlds kind of came together in your life and how you talk with fellow gun enthusiasts about gun safety.
Absolutely. So my dad is a military veteran. He served in the Army. I grew up with guns in the home. My husband and I are active sport shooters. And it's sort of always been something that was a part of our lives, a recreational activity, also with training and sort of respecting guns as tools and not toys. But as I started entering my PhD program and studying injury and violence prevention, I realized that there aren't very many folks, at least not in public health, who study this issue who also own firearms. Now, much like Dr. Semenza said, gun violence isn't a monolith, neither are gun owners a monolith, right? There are lots of different reasons why people own firearms, and it's not to say that I can speak for all gun owners, but I certainly can bring a different perspective to some of the public health and policy conversations. You know, it's not sufficient to say, well, if we just educated gun owners about the risks, then they wouldn't own firearms. Like, that fundamentally ignores the reasons why some people choose to have firearms in the home or choose to hunt or sport shoot. And when I'm talking with gun owners, you know, the immediate pushback, particularly being at the Bloomberg School of Public Health, is that I just want to take everyone's guns away. And I can reflect back, well, no, I'm a lawful owner. I'm responsible. I want us to co-create solutions together. But we can't do that if we are not engaging gun owners, not engaging public health researchers, public safety, all of these folks. We really need to take this harm reduction approach. And being able to sort of straddle that, those two perspectives has really helped me think differently about the problem and also solutions.
Well, let me ask you this question then, Cassandra, from Mark, who says, if we value human life, it's high time that we made gun ownership more expensive. What about an annual public safety fee for gun owners for each gun they own, for example? Someone needs to bear the cost of keeping society safe from gun violence, he says, and he says it should be those who own guns. What about an idea like that, making it more expensive?
It's a really great question. And one thing I want to raise, Dr. Semenza had touched on this a little bit. You know, there are a lot of guns in the U.S., but most guns are never going to be used in crime. Most guns are used by people who own them lawfully and responsibly. We have around 68 million gun owners in the U.S., sort of at our best estimate. And yes, we have too many guns on our streets and communities and falling into the hands of people who shouldn't have them. But we need to be thinking about how they're getting into the wrong hands. We need to be thinking about gun dealers who are engaging in irresponsible sales practices. We know from prior work that a very small percentage, less than 5% of gun dealers in the U.S., are responsible for selling upwards of 50 to 70% of guns recovered in crime. So we really need to focus on that supply side. But at the end of the day, policy alone isn't going to be the single solution. No single policy is going to touch on all forms of violence. No single policy will get us to where we need to be. That doesn't mean we don't do anything. We take a layered approach, like Dr. Semenza said, but we also need to focus on programs. We need to focus on the areas in our cities, thinking about interpersonal violence, gun homicide, non-fatal shooting for a moment. Why are there areas where there's concentrated disadvantage and high rates of violence? It's because we have systematically disinvested in those places and put policies in place to concentrate this disadvantage, leading to a lack of economic opportunities, exposure to lead and other environmental toxins that can be harmful. And so we need to think about violence prevention programs at the community level, addressing structural issues that have led to this concentrated disadvantage. All of that is to say, we really need to be taking a multifaceted approach, and certainly economic incentives or disincentives could be one strategy. Some smaller jurisdictions have talked about requiring people to have insurance or paying a tax. There have been some challenges with implementing that, but we can certainly think about new innovative strategies that can use some other tools that we haven't traditionally leveraged.
Well, and as a follow-up to that, Daniel, let me ask you this question from Gregory, who says, having lived in both rural Pennsylvania and Philadelphia, I think many rural politicians and voters choose to oppose gun laws because they see gun violence as a, quote, urban problem that doesn't affect their own lives. Seems like there's an underlying racial component to perceptions as to who the, quote, dangerous people are, he says.
Yeah, I agree. There is a rural-urban disconnect for sure in how both sides of things are thinking about this. And I think this binary of the good guy with a gun versus the bad guy with a gun, who is going to use it for good, who is going to use it for wrong, is fundamentally flawed. It doesn't make sense. There is no person who on high is good and therefore will always use a gun for a good purpose and vice versa. Somebody who's bad and will use it for a bad purpose, and certainly nothing that is racially motivated around that kind of binary. But I think that this confusion and these misperceptions on both sides come from a lack of understanding in that guns are connected across rural and urban spaces. And what I mean by that is every gun that is manufactured in the United States or imported into the United States starts its, quote, life as a gun at a federally licensed dealer, right? And then from those licensed dealers, they are purchased by people and then can move into a secondary market where they are, you know, illegal guns. And those often move into cities where guns are used on an everyday basis in a lot of the homicides and non-fatal shootings that make up the majority of gun violence. And so for somebody who is a politician in a more rural area to just point to the city and say, that's the problem. Well, a lot of guns cross over state lines. You know, they move from rural places into more urban areas, and that's where a lot of crime ends up being committed. There are guns that are purchased legally, but then they are, you know, locked or unlocked in cars and then are stolen and then move into those secondary markets. And so there are all these kind of leaking parts of the pipeline from, you know, legal access to the gun dealer to where they end up on the streets used in a crime that you really have to take a holistic approach, and you can't just point fingers at one side or the other and say this is really your problem and not our problem. It is all connected, and we have to think that way if we're going to make meaningful impacts here.
Cassandra Sally asks, what about regulating ammunition? She says, I don't hear enough among policymakers about limiting the amount of ammunition a person can buy. She says, it seems like that would be a valuable policy.
Yeah, it's also another great question. There haven't been movements to limit the amount of ammunition that anyone can purchase. There are some states that have put background checks in place for ammunition, which I think for states that don't have that policy, that's a real missed opportunity. If you are prohibited from owning a firearm, you're also prohibited from owning ammunition. And so if we're not doing background checks on people who are buying ammunition, we're missing an opportunity to identify people who are prohibited, who are buying ammunition. And logically, if they're buying ammunition, they probably have a gun to use that ammunition with. I think one of the pushbacks we would likely hear if we tried to limit ammunition purchasing is that there are a lot of individuals who engage in competitive shooting, sport shooting, target shooting, where they may go through a lot of rounds. And at the end of the day, if you want to harm yourself or someone else, you probably don't need a lot of rounds. You only need a few. There have been talks about making ammunition very expensive, for example. But I think a better approach would be making sure we're applying the same screening procedures for purchasing guns to purchasing ammunition, so we can try to identify and screen out people who shouldn't have them in the first place. Yeah.
Daniel, you talked a moment ago about the gun pipeline and how a gun can start somewhere and end up in an entirely different place. What about ghost guns, the guns that are untraceable? They can be assembled fairly quickly with a kit. How is the government addressing that problem, and how difficult is it to regulate guns that are intentionally supposed to be under the radar?
Yeah, ghost guns, I think, pose a relatively new challenge to what we're talking about here. My understanding of it is that ghost guns comprise a relatively small percentage of the guns that are being used and recovered in crimes, but that in a lot of states that is growing. And so an approach like New Jersey's, which is passing, you know, kind of stricter regulations and penalties for using ghost guns and having those recovered, I think is a very proactive approach to thinking about this and in saying, look, if ghost guns are not necessarily a big part of the crime issue right now, there's a very real possibility that it could be in the next couple of years if they're not properly regulated and there aren't proper penalties. And so, again, you know, as somebody who is from New Jersey, living here and working in the Jersey Gun Violence Center, I would say that here New Jersey is being a model for how other states can think about this and is trying to get ahead of the problem rather than, say, in a couple of years, trying to do a lot of tracing and recovering around ghost guns that are specifically designed to be untraceable and difficult to recover. And so, yeah, I think it's really thinking about a proactive approach, again, using legislation where you can to cover some gaps so that you can kind of prevent things down the line.
Yeah. As we get into our final moments here, I want to ask both of you, and Cass, I'll begin with you on this question. People are rightly very concerned about gun safety. People are frustrated. It seems that every time we turn around, we hear about another mass shooting or some form of gun violence. For people who feel helpless as they're watching all of this, what can people do to channel that frustration? 30 seconds or less.
Sure. I would encourage people to find a local organization in their city, county, or state where they can become more educated on the efforts at the state level. They can work to advocate for reasonable restrictions on gun ownership and to fund needed programs and policies to make sure that we can use the solutions that we already have that touch on multiple forms of violence.
And Daniel, what do you say? 30 seconds.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's hard to feel hopeful sometimes these days with incidents happening every single day. My answer is vote and think about how you can get more involved politically. The midterm elections are coming up. Find the candidate that you feel aligns with how you are thinking about gun violence, and find the candidate that you think is strong and is actually going after this issue in a meaningful way. And if you can't find that candidate, you know, whether it's now or in a couple of years, think about how maybe you can be that candidate, right? And that sounds pie in the sky, and that sounds very simple, but we have seen just in recent years, in response to Donald Trump becoming president, a lot of candidates coming out and saying, no, I'm basically not accepting that, and I'm going to run on these particular issues and become involved politically and be active in that way. And I say that is the next best approach.
Yeah. Well, Daniel Semenza, Cassandra Crafazzi, I want to thank both of you for being with us on Radio Times and helping us understand this complicated issue.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. Our producers are Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray Bessler, and our engineer has been Diana Martinez. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane.